You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2022 Vuelta España, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Today we are in Les Praeres, Nava.
Hello, buenas tardes from La Vuelta a España. My name is Daniel Freema. I am the host of tonight's episode. And as you heard our friend Rob Hatch just say, I am on Les Praeres in Asturias. Tonight, joining me from Pietrasanta in Tuscany, is the former Leopard Trek team manager, Team CSC, Team Sky, and Orica Green Edge communications manager, now Bon Vivant and wine industry savant, the fanciest Dan on the cycling podcast roster, because we established last night, or I established, I pronounced that his wine cellar was probably better than Dan Martin's. It's the man who said that Remco Evenepoel would never win a Grand Tour. It's Brian Nygaard.
Thank you very much for that introduction.
Brian, how are you feeling about your prediction? Pronouncement.
I don't mind being corrected by reality. Yeah, God knows it wouldn't be the first time. It's still 2 weeks of racing to go. Still a lot of possibilities to have a meltdown or make major mistakes. But yeah, he's looking very good now, isn't he, young Remco?
He is looking very good. Also looking very good, Brian, is the landscape up here on Les Praeres. Beautiful scene. We were up here in 2018, of course, surrounded by cattle, in fact, I am, Brian. And cow
careful,
pats.
Careful where you're walking.
Yeah, very careful. But there's a bit of an end-of-term feel about tonight's stage, which suggests it's a happy atmosphere. The end-of-term feel, that comes from the fact that it's the end of the first tranche, really, of the Vuelta, and there's a rest day tomorrow, a long drive to Alicante. We'll talk about that later. What is less in keeping with the end-of-term feel is that there were a lot of bad-tempered riders at the finish tonight, or a lot of riders who had pretty bad days, didn't want to speak to the press. There's a bit of a strange arrangement with an ad hoc mix zone at the finishes here at the Vuelta, and it's not easy to speak to riders. And certainly there weren't too many who were keen to talk about Les Praeres, not least because it was a pretty brutal climb, as most people will have seen on TV. Concrete surface in parts, so the last few hundred metres they're on gravel, really, as discussed on yesterday's stage. And the gradients are savage. In fact, Brian, before we get to the stage summary time trial, let's hear the description of one rider shortly after he came over the finish line, and that's Luke Clapp of Ineos Grenadiers. Here's what he had to say about Les Praeres.
Well, how filthy was that climb?
Mate, that's got to be the hardest finish I've ever done.
Borderline inhumane, wasn't it?
Yeah, 100%. Mate, that was any slower and you were rolling back down it. That was that was ridiculous, but loved every minute of it at the same time.
And what you said earlier in the Vuelta, you hadn't quite found your climbing legs yet. Are they any closer to arriving?
No, I don't think so at all. No, they're not there, but that's all right. I'm still loving it, and I'm helping the boys when I can. And look, Carlos is killing it, so it keeps me happy crossing the finish line every time and knowing he's up there.
Bit of a mixed bag today for the team. Teo crashed, Carlos did a fantastic ride. Pavel was good again, back to himself, I think. It's like that, this Vuelta, isn't it? I mean, you never know what you're going to get. Every day is a sort of box of chocolates.
Oh, I think so, mate. And I keep getting told as well the race doesn't start till Tuesday. So I think it's just the prelude now at the moment. Carlos is in a great spot. Unfortunately for Teo, yeah, it's not great. But at the same time, like, so much is going to happen in the rest of this race. And it's definitely not over, mate.
Well, Brian, should we get straight down to business? You heard Luke Clapp there talk about how savage, how brutal, how horrible, how ineffably inhumane this final climb was. But what kind of stage did we have overall? Brian, are you primed? Have you got your aero gear, your skin suit on? And are you ready for...
They don't make heads much more aero than mine, as you know.
Rob Hatch, take it away, first of all.
El resumen del día a contrarreloj. The stage summary time trial.
It is the resumen de la etapa a contrarreloj. Brian Nygaard, you have 90 seconds. Off you go.
Well, So 171 kilometers from Villa Viciosa to Las Prairies. After some big name attacking at the start of the stage, nine riders got away, with Luis Mainz being the best placed at 8:28. Quickstep Alpha Vinyl took care of most of the work in the peloton during the day. With 17 kilometers to go, attacks started going off in the breakaway. Two riders got away, but it wasn't until the end that the rider from the nine-rider breakaway, Luis Mainz, just passed them, going on to win the stage. Meanwhile, in the very reduced peloton, Alaphilippe hit the technical descent before the climb, launching Remco Evenepoel to do what he does best, which is currently to drop riders out of his wheel. He did that. He gained significant amount of time.
And defy Brian Nygaard.
Gained significant amount of time. He is now leading the Vuelta with even a bigger gap to Enric Mas, which is now 1:12. The best of the rest was actually Spanish today, with Ayuso, Mas, and then Rodriguez. Roglic and Simon Yates were some of the riders who lost a bit more time than I would have imagined before, but that's Las Prairies for you. Thank you very much.
Any more news on the various different classifications, Brian? GC,
yeah, so GC,
KOM Jersey,
yeah,
youth,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, so GC, Remco is now leading the Vuelta with 1:12 to Mas, 1:53 to Roglic in third. Simon Yates goes up one spot and he is now currently in sixth, but he's 3 minutes down. Nothing new on the points classification. There wasn't anything to fight for today. Jay Vine is still leading the KOM with almost double points, with 40-21 Robert Stannard in second. Same team, obviously. How many years can Remco actually
I think until about 2034, yeah. I think he qualifies.
There you go. But he's safely in that as well, obviously, with the 2:33 to Carlos Rodriguez of Ineos Grenadiers.
If he was to be eligible in 2034, that would mean extending the eligibility window for that competition. A bit like we extended the permissible window for your 90-second time trial. But very good performance there, Brian.
I'm getting better. I would say I'm leaving out a bunch of important stuff, which is much to what I'm doing in the rest of my life right now.
One thing I did ask you to do, Brian, is recap if there were any DNSs this morning, because we usually do a pretty poor job of that, of telling people who did not start stage.
Yeah, three significant ones. Wout Poels from Bahrain Victorious, Peter Seri from Quickstep Alpha Vinyl, and Sepp Kuss of Jumbo-Visma.
Extremely significant ones, certainly in the case of Sepp Kuss. Peter Seri, also significant because he's one of Remco Evenepoel's key domestics. Also a chicken farmer, Dan Martin told me a couple of days ago. I don't know whether we discussed this in last night's podcast. We may have done. Anyway, this had me thinking about... Brian, are you a follower of cricket? I don't suppose you are as a Dane.
Not at all. I've walked in on Michael Hepburn watching it religiously more than once, and it almost looked as embarrassed as someone was like... looking at awkward stuff on the internet. It was not something to be disturbed while happening. Yeah, I don't get it. I mean, watching paint dry, isn't it?
Well, for me, if I was to then liken or compare or draw some kind of parallel between Peter Seri and Edo Brandis, there was a Zimbabwean cricketer called Edo Brandis who was a chicken farmer. He became very, very, very famous purely on account of an insult he aimed in the direction of, I can't remember which player it was, but it was something about this player's significant other eating biscuits, and yes, that was his only claim to fame. That was a significant tangent, but Sepp Kuss, as you said, well, he was the most significant absentee today, and well, Primoz Roglic did feel his absence, I would suggest, out there on the road to Les Prairies. There was more trouble for Jumbo-Visma because Chris Harper had a nasty crash on that really sinewy, twisty, dangerous road into the bottom of the climb, and he finished the stage, and I spoke to his team afterwards, and he seems to be okay. He's got a rest day tomorrow to recover.
I think it also is definitely worth mentioning, and because Tao Gegenhardt was in that crash as well, and he actually lost seven places in the GC, and he's now down on 12th, almost 6 minutes behind Evenepoel.
Yes, and understandably, Tao was not particularly happy when he crossed the finish line. like a lot of other riders, as I said, and Brian, we just mentioned a couple of, well, we mentioned one rider from Quickstep Alpha Vinyl, one rider from Jumbo Visma. Let's hear from another couple of representatives of those two teams. I've just spoken to them after the finish. One is Ilan van Wilder, domestique to Remco Evenepoel and his compatriot. The other is Adi Engels, the Jumbo Visma director sportif. Let's hear from them now.
Yes, in the end, I think we have a really strong team. Achieved a good goal today. It was really difficult for us, especially in the start. Everyone seemed to attack us in the start. They were really putting the pressure on us, but we stayed calm and we controlled the race like yesterday. And we put Remco in top three position at the bottom of the final climb, and then it was directly up to the GC guys. So he had good legs, and we were happy to help him all day, and we're just happy that we went through this day safely. Take what you can take, I would say. He's feeling good now. We are helping him. These are the difficult days, so here you need to take as much advantage as possible.
Okay, Adi, well, average day or bad day, would you say, for Primoz? Maybe a good day.
To be honest, I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen him, I haven't spoken to him. I think in terms of only looking to the result, a little bit better than average.
Yeah.
After yesterday, maybe I won't say good, but for sure not bad. For the team, it was a bad day. With
Chris and Sepp, obviously.
With Sepp, falling ill last night. Mike also suffering with also yesterday a hard day, and then today also suffering, and then also crashing, and then Chris crashing in the final. So it's a bit of bad luck.
There's a lot of pressure now on Sam, I suppose, in the mountains. How's he doing?
Yeah, he's doing fine, and for sure Chris was also doing fine, and I think the other guys are doing. Mike, like I said, is suffering. The other guys are doing fine. We hope someone can step up a bit, but also, to be honest, what I said also this morning already, you cannot just replace Sepp by saying someone else got to do that. Yeah. You know, a good Sepp is with the best climbers in the world, and that's something special. So, but for sure, those guys are doing, and hopefully Chris is. I also don't know. I mean, I know he finished and he's on the way down now. So. Hopefully he's pretty okay. He was doing well. Sam is doing well. Robert is doing well for the climbs. Rowan is improving. So, yeah, that's okay. That's okay. But like I said, it's not easy to replace Sepp, if not impossible.
Does a new Vuelta start on Tuesday? Or, you know, you hope the second half of the Vuelta will be a little bit different from the first?
If it's a new Vuelta starting, we have then again same time, everyone, or what? No, there's not a new Vuelta starting. We continue with this one. I know what you mean, but I think it's just it will continue like this. I think, also when you look at others, they try to take the opportunities that are there, and so are we. And for the moment, this is it. But still very hopeful. Still 2 weeks to go. Like I said a few days ago, then Primoz needed to make a step up. He did. I think he did also again today compared to a few days ago, but still a little bit more. Or others have to go a little less fast. That's also possible. But no, for the moment, this is it, and we have to deal with it. First rest day, then a TT, and which is no tactics at all. Just do what we can, and then we'll see.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2022 Vuelta España, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insights, and personalized analytics. We're here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
Thank you very much to Super Sapiens, our title sponsors. Now, the Super Sapiens technology can help everybody tweak and fine-tune and improve their fueling for performance. But for Sam Brand of the Novo Nordisk team, it is a fact of life. He needs to monitor his glucose levels to manage his type 1 diabetes. All the riders on the team are type 1 diabetics, and we've been hearing from Sam about a recent big day out at the Tour of Poland when he got into a break that lasted for more than 200 kilometres.
Well, the group was five of us, and there were three guys from Poland, two obviously from the national team, but one from Lotto Soudal, as well as one guy from Uno X. So the three Polish guys were speaking to each other quite a lot, and then it kind of knew that they wanted it to stay away, so the collaboration was there. But obviously then you have it in the back of your mind, if anything's going to happen, there's three guys who are from the same country who all know each other, so it's, you got to keep all that in your mind, all that in play whilst you're sort of keeping the break away. So it's ace, and I love that. You know, I love that mental sort of collaboration, the trying to work and trying to figure everything out and you run through scenarios. You know, it keeps the day fresh. And I was just making sure that I did my work. I wasn't skipping turns. I just make sure I keep them happy until, you know, at some point that communication is going to break down. We know that. So it was just all about doing my thing, looking after myself and making sure that I was ready.
El Diario Remco, the Daily Remco.
The guy, we have a really strong team for this final. I think Julien and Ilan show their strength, also Louis. But I think Julien and Ilan will be more important for today's final, and then it's up to me to not lose any time. And yeah, it's actually the first 2K that is really steep. After that, it's going to be a bit more easy. But yeah, I know Simon Yates won here, so he's going to be an important guy for the stage win maybe. But for us, an easy, controllable breakaway would be perfect.
That was the Daily Remco, El Diario Remco, our daily journey into the mind and musings of the man that Brian Nygaard says will never win a Grand Tour. Brian, Remco was quite impressive today, was he not? He said there that he thought he had an excellent team for today's race, for today's course. And we saw that in particular, I thought, in those last few kilometres before the final climb, because, well, the TV pictures did not do the precariousness of those kilometres justice.
No, it definitely didn't. I thought of Remco the other day after you and I spoke and watching the World Cup, you know, and the stages after. I think it definitely serves him well. I think he sometimes rides those climbs, especially the finishing climbs, a bit like a TT, because he's a rider who grew up in a very short amount of time he's been in cycling. He's grown up looking and reading his watts extremely well, and I think that he is quite good at, on the last climb, basically like resetting or whatever he does on his power meter, and then not purely but almost looking at the numbers for when he needs to go and when he needs to stop. I don't think there's that much of a tactic. It wouldn't be on Las Playas anyways, but I don't think there's a lot of tactics in what he's doing currently. I think he's just racing to his limit and then seeing what the damage is that he's able to do. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so, Brian. I would agree with that. I would also say that, you know, we talked at the start of the World Tour about the lack of Grand Tour heritage at Quickstep and how he might come undone as a result of that. That certainly hasn't appeared to be the case so far. I mean, he's got a great road captain in Julien Alaphilippe. He's got a lot of experience there. The other members of the team, well, until Peter Seri pulled out today through illness, they seem to be healthy and they seem to be in good form, crucially, because that is not necessarily the case of all the GC contenders teams here. And, well, they've done a very good job so far, haven't they? The one sort of caveat I would add is that it has felt like a bit of a sort of Tirreno Adriatico kind of course so far. And, well, this is something we talked about in relation to the route generally, that there are a lot of stages with sort of less than 4,000 meters of climbing that might be billed as mountain stages, but if you look closely at the profile, and if you look closely at today's profile, it was more of a sort of tour of the Basque Country stage. The climbs were not high, there was no high altitude. We're at just over, I think, 700 meters here, where I'm speaking from right now on Les Prayeres, and that has suited Remco well. But the route will continue to suit Remco well until we get to Andalusia and La Pandera particularly, and the Sierra Nevada itself next week. But, you know, by then, we'll also be 2 weeks into the race. And Brian, you and I, we have often spoken about this, how people jump very hastily to conclusions in Grand Tours. It's partly, I think, a result of the sort of short attention spans that generally prevail in today's culture, that people rush to cast sort of sweeping judgments about what's happening, what's going to happen in Grand Tours. And, you know, this could be a very different race when we get to the next rest day. Would you not agree?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and, you know, you shouldn't, you should hold back judgment. I can't say that I did by saying, Evenepoel when I went to GC. But that was a universal statement, not a early Vuelta statement. And I think everyone knows, even if you like to pass judgment quite early, it's going to go down in the third week, and you can look at the profile and trying to find some hidden places where they can be won or lost, but it's all down to how well they've recuperated and how fresh they are in the last week, even if there's no major time trial to shake things up. I think that a lot could still happen in the podium. I think some riders are already out of it, but some could definitely still come back and be contenders.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose what we haven't seen so far that we expected to see from Remco Evenepoel, those of us, I suppose, in the media particularly, who are sceptics, are signs of sort of that rashness and that kind of youthful volatility that we have seen from Remco Evenepoel thus far in his career. You know, whether it's sort of berating guys who are not taking turns on the front. I mean, even, you know, Enric Mas has sort of provoked him a couple of times by sucking his wheel all the way up climbs and then even attacking him in the last few hundred metres. And he didn't seem fazed by that. He's definitely not looking fazed by the amount of attention that he's getting every morning in the mix zone and after the finish every day. He seems to be loving it, in fact. And, you know, there is a euphoria that kicks in generally with bike riders, I think, when they have fantastic legs. I think it sort of leaks and seeps into every element of their life and every aspect of the way they carry themselves. Would you agree with that, Brian?
Yeah, definitely. And if you compare how he was developing, I wouldn't even say that, but how he was walking backwards in the Giro and when Bernal was basically putting him under pressure on places where he still didn't have a fully developed skill set, being it descending on gravel, you know, descending in wet weather and things like that. I think the amount of experience he's had from not doing great in Grand Tours is serving him well now. And now that he's also a different bike rider than he was back then, with a wealth of experience. And, you know, he also came in here after pummeling everyone in St. Sebastian. So you can't really say that he's not mentally ready, because no one's really been able to do a lot about his superiority so far.
Perhaps we are making a mistake in not sort of considering Enric Mas the second or the major threat to Remco Evenepoel. But I think that seems to be the feeling around the race. And because of the way Enric Mas has ridden in the past, relatively defensively, the way we've seen him, well, he generally rides well in the last week, but we've never really seen him threaten to win a Grand Tour. We didn't see that last year, and he sort of found himself in second place. So Roglic is the guy that everyone is looking to, also bearing in mind the 31-kilometre time trial on Tuesday. But Brian, I mean, Primoz Roglic, because of the setbacks that he's suffered over the last couple of years, he often seems a slightly embattled figure due to circumstances often, and that has been the case, that is the case today, I think, with Chris Harper crashing, Sepp Kuss having to leave the race through illness, and, you know, a team that doesn't, well, in contrast to the impression they gave a week ago after the team time trial in particular, a team that doesn't seem to be in the best of health. Sam Omen hasn't appeared to me to be riding particularly well. I don't think Rowan Dennis is absolutely on top of his game. I spoke to Rowan Dennis yesterday morning, in fact, and he was relatively chipper, and the team say he's getting better, but it's not the Rowan Dennis that we saw provide absolutely key assistance to Theo Gegenhardt when he won the Giro d'Italia in 2020.
Now, he was a game changer back then for Tao. And I think if you looked at Roglic, even if he was, let's say he was leading the world's now slender lead or whatever, with Kuss out, his and those other guys not being 100%, he would be in trouble, in my opinion, especially when you look at the climbing possibilities he's up against. So even now, with the team reduced as it is, and with him, and I don't really think he has a lot of... He's never good once he's broken, in my opinion. We see that. I mean, he's had some nasty crashes in the Tour, and the last 2 years he hasn't finished it. But I don't really see him rising above where he is now, having lost time and not having the best of teams behind him. So I think the best he can hope for, I mean, he can regain some time on the TT, but not to Evenepoel. The best he can hope for, in my opinion, is the podium at this point.
And Brian, just behind Roglic now, we've got two Spaniards, Carlos Rodriguez and Juan Ayuso, who contributed to a great day, really, for the Spaniards today. At one point, it was the three Spanish hopes together, Mas, Rodriguez and Ayuso. I mean, they are extremely young riders. Ayuso is still a teenager and Rodriguez 21. But they look extremely promising, don't they? And Rodriguez has been the most consistent of the Ineos GC riders so far. I mean, Carapaz yesterday, there was a bit of a postscript to yesterday's stage.
Well, Carapaz today. Carapaz this morning.
Yes, yes. Carapaz yesterday, a lot of people noticed him. Well, he obviously was in the break initially and then went back. And there was some speculation about whether he'd been called back. There was also then speculation about whether he was unhappy with that order, that instruction, and he ripped the earpiece out of his ear. And I think he even sort of went back to the car and handed the radio back. And he was asked about that, I think, last night and this morning. And he wasn't explicit about what had actually happened. It was a little bit coded. He said it was just a chaotic day and nothing really worked for the team yesterday. But he's not having a good Vuelta. Theo Gegenhardt got very unlucky today and he had a bad day. Pavel Sivakov we'll hear from later. His Vuelta bid was really derailed yesterday. So Rodriguez is by far the most consistent up to now anyway.
I think an interesting perspective now is also, I mean, Evenepoel is climbing better than anyone, I would say. But the people, I mean, and he's going to take more time on the purer climbers on the TT on Tuesday. But the group of riders behind him and the group of riders who I think can potentially shake the race up are all young climbers. You still see Sami Yates is young, but especially Ayuso, who is barely old enough to have a drink if he wins a bike race. And then Carlos Rodriguez. And I think those guys, I don't think they're afraid to lose as much as they really want to try and shake things up. I don't think that neither of them are riding for top five just for the sake of it. So hopefully that'll revamp some action into the race in case Evenepoel is looking potentially just as strong as we go into the second week of the race.
Carlos Rodriguez also has one of my lame nicknames as of today. I decided in the car on the way to the finish today that he would henceforth be known as Sugar Man. Rodriguez, of course, the elusive sort of mystical singer who was tracked down and was the star of the award-winning documentary Searching for Sugar Man. I hope to find out that Carlos Rodriguez has a really sweet tooth and loves nothing better than to guzzle a bag of Haribo.
Doesn't look like it.
It doesn't look like it. I should have waited though to establish to find out a bit more about his eating habits before I christened him Sugar Man, but I couldn't wait.
Questions to you, Daniel Freebie. Are you familiar with the Swedish children's author Astrid Lindgren?
I may have heard the name.
Okay, she's very famous. One of her most famous characters is called Carlson on the Roof. Does that ring a bell to you?
No.
Looks exactly like Remco Evenepoel.
Really?
Like, nice. For all our Scandinavian listeners who I'm sure are familiar with Carlson on the Roof, once they see those images, I might be wrong about his potential as a GC rider, but I certainly know which Astrid Lindgren character he looks like. So I'm regaining a little bit of my integrity here.
I think we should dedicate the rest of the podcast to just going through the whole peloton and giving those who don't already have nicknames creative sobriquets. And Brian, another one you might appreciate, and I've been calling Matthias Norsgaard, who rocks up every morning, parks up every morning next to me in the mix zone, because I tend to stand alongside TV2 of Denmark, so he's there every morning. And he's a big lad. I don't know how tall he is, well over 190 centimeters, 6'4" in English British language, and
I was looking for him for DNF today.
Yeah, he's also sick. He's also not feeling very well. So I don't know how he got on those 20% plus slopes. But he's also quite heavy, over 80 kilos. It came to me spontaneously the other day. The family size milkshake, the mega milkshake, the big milkshake. Also a gentle giant, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah, he is. He's also, but I don't know how much you've been talking to him in that context. But he's definitely also someone to speak his mind, like in a big way. And I'm often thinking, Jesus, he should be happy no one speaks Danish on Movistar, because he's definitely not afraid to voice his disagreement with the team decision making when being interviewed by, especially by your Danish colleagues from TV2.
Oh, fantastic, fantastic. I'll make a beeline for the mega milkshake on Tuesday. Brian, the stage winner, Louis Meintjes, a man who has more Tour de France top 10s to his name than Primoz Roglic. Finished 8th in the Tour de France 3 times. Has become a bit of a specialist, not to the same extent as Guillaume Martin, but a bit of a specialist of the art of riding himself out of general classification to subsequently ride himself back into it. Darwin Atapuma was the founder of this movement in professional cycling. But Meintjes does it as well. And today he always looked, on paper, like the best climber in that group that went away, didn't he?
Yeah, and then also the best, you know, there's a reason why he's the best in GC, and he was the best in GC in that group anyways. But I remember when I started commentating, it was also during those years when he was doing so well in GC, and I would go through an entire tour without actually knowing what he looked like, because he's always hiding away in the peloton. He was always in this sort of the second category of riders who couldn't aim for the podium, who would barely make top 5, but always in top 10. It wasn't until a couple of years ago that I actually found out what he looked like.
Well, last year in the Vuelta, I remember speaking to him, and he opened up a little bit about some of the issues that he'd had with his weight. I think he was one of these riders that pushed the envelope a little bit too far as weight loss was concerned. And he's rebuilt his career quietly and very much in the same vein as that team. Intermarché has built quite an impressive, well, certainly has some very impressive results, but they've built a good roster of stage hunters and guys of that nature who are sort of looking for a second chance, guys who have maybe been forgotten, overlooked, considered to be over the hill, and it's been very effective for them. I mean, last year we saw Ryan Taramay and odd Christian Eiking in the Vuelta a España, and well, they've had
moneyballing.
Yes, it is. And well, a fantastic result for them today, fantastic result for Louis Meintjes, and well, that's made their Vuelta a España already.
El ritmo de la Vuelta. The rhythm of the Vuelta.
This is El Ritmo de la Vuelta, our daily date with the Vuelta jukebox and the official songs that have serenaded Spain's Grand Tour since the late 1970s. Today we are going back to 1999. Why? Well, the performer handed the honour of performing that year's official song was born in Villaviciosa, the Asturian town where today's ninth stage of the 2022 Vuelta began. His name is José Ángel Hevia Velasco, better known just as Hevia, and he's one of Spain's premier bagpipe players, an instrument that features in a lot of indigenous music in this part of northern Spain. The song is El Garrotín, and Garrotín is a kind of improvised song featuring flamenco singing, dancing and guitar playing, which developed near the end of the 19th century in Asturias. The The other reason for choosing this Vuelta a España today is that yesterday we talked about the last ever edition to feature the Maillot Oro, the golden jersey. That was in 2009 and it was won by Alejandro Valverde, whereas this was the first. The race rolled out from Murcia on September the 4th with defending champion Abraham Olano, most pundits' favourite for overall victory. Olano duly took the Maillot Oro on stage 5 to Ciudad Rodrigo. But that day was more significant for Jan Ullrich, who had missed the Tour de France with a knee injury, taking a stage win in a 23-man sprint. Olano took the flowers the following day, but Ullrich was growing into the race and would dethrone the Spaniard on stage 12 at Arcalis in Andorra, the same resort where the German had taken the Maillot Jaune in the 1997 Tour de France that he went on to win. Here, similarly, as one by one, his challengers faded, with the exception of Igor González de Galliano. Ulrich proved impervious to every attack and held on to win in Madrid. He was the third German to win the Vuelta after Rudi Altig in 1962 and Rolf Wolschol in 1965. The addition was also significant for the Angliru's world premiere and Chava Jiménez's victory there ahead of the mighty Pavel Tonkov. The late Frank Vandenbroek also took a pair of swashbuckling stage wins in 1999, and there were also four stage wins for the German sprinter Marcel Wüst. You remember that Vuelta, Brian?
Yeah, I remember it very well. I'm quite interested in the, obviously, both the Ulrich story, but definitely also the Vandenbroek story, and the way he wrote. I mean, he was even helping Ulrich at some point, just for the sake of it, I think. Yeah, and it was that Vuelta where everyone thought Vandenbroek would basically win the Worlds in Verona with 5 minutes with both hands on his back. He didn't, but he was, I think he crashed midway, didn't he?
Well, he couldn't with both of his hands folded behind his back because he broke his wrist, didn't he, early in the race.
Yeah.
But he still sort of dominated. He and Ulrich still kind of dominated that Worlds. Neither of them won the race. The race was won by Oscar Freire.
Yeah, exactly. But I was there. It was my first World Championships. I went there by train. I think I still owe my brother for the ticket, but yeah, it was a life-changing experience for me sitting on a balcony in Verona for a week. So I remember everything about that 99 Worlds. I remember everything about every single 99 race because I was supposed to write my thesis and I was watching cycling instead.
And the thesis was not about professional cycling in 1999, unfortunately. What was it about, no, Brian?
It was about the problem of reference in Wittgenstein's rule following argument in newer interpretations.
Oh, okay. All right. That's enough. That's
you want more?
No, not really. Not really, Brian. Maybe another day. And Brian, I wanted to, in this part, talk a little bit more about some other riders who came into this Vuelta a España with big ambitions. There were even more sort of GC pretenders than in usual Grand Tours. There was this whole sort of tier of riders who, well, now are sort of occupying what in Formula One I think would be referred to as the midfield, the sort of positions between about 5th place and 15th place on the general classification. But they all sort of came in thumping their chests, hoping, and well, telling us that they were aiming for the top five or that maybe even the podium. I'm talking about guys like Hugh Carthy, Pavel Sivakov, Jai Hindley, Rigo Ran, Esteban Chavez, Timon Arensman, Ben O'Connor, Superbok, Wilco Kelderman, Simon Yates, Superman Lopez, and there were others as well. Not all of them, I should say. You know, Pavel Sivakov didn't say that he was going to finish on the podium or the top five, but they all had some kind of ambition for general classification. We'll hear from three of them just to kick us off. I spoke to three of them this morning, in fact. Hugh Carthy of EF Education First, who today, I can tell you, after today's stage, he's 15th on general classification, 5 minutes and 58 seconds down. Didn't have a great day today. And Pavel Sivakov, well, as we've already mentioned, his Vuelta sort of ran aground a little bit yesterday. He was a bit better today, but he's 5 minutes and 39 seconds down. He's in 10th place. And Jai Hindley is just hanging on in the top 10. He's 5 minutes and 36 seconds down. So let's hear from that trio this morning.
Well, Hugh, how do you think it's gone so far? Pretty good position, 15th on GC, close enough to the top 10.
Yeah, not too bad. I think I'm getting better. We lost a bit of time in the team time trial, but yeah, I'm feeling better, feeling like I'm recovering okay, and I'm there or thereabouts. Not amazing, but still optimistic. You know, with the way the Giro went, I think I'll be similar here. I think I'll get stronger. Hopefully I'll get stronger as the race goes on.
We were a bit surprised. I think everyone was that you guys lost as much time as you did in the team time trial. Well, what did you think was the explanation for that in the end after the kind of debrief?
I think the team we brought here, we brought a team of climbers. We were targeting stages and sort of the overall. And yeah, with the way the calendar is at the moment, we couldn't bring four people to just to guide us around the TTT. So we had to, use what we had. It wasn't the sort of best team for a team time trial like other teams had, but it was what it was. I think we did a good performance and we got through it. And yeah, a minute over 3 weeks isn't, it's not ideal, but it wasn't, it's not going to change a huge amount, so it was what it was. Then after that, the strategy didn't change. We've not changed much. Chipping away, moving up, and hopefully just keep doing the same. Hopefully just keep doing the same, and the others will get more tired, and I'll keep recovering well and just do my own thing.
Was it one of those when you knew that it was coming, you didn't feel good all day?
No, it was the opposite, actually. I felt quite good, and then it came, and yeah, maybe something didn't click yesterday. Yeah, I didn't see it coming, to be honest. I felt quite good all day. But yeah, that's how it is. I mean, I was a bit disappointed after the stage, but at the end the shape is there. I think it won't disappear in one day. The race is still long, still a lot of long climbs. I think, I lost about 2 minutes, but the boys did a really good job. They are still like in top five in GC. That might actually give us a bit more options. I think we still have a lot of freedom, every one of us. I still have a little card to play for GC now. I mean, obviously the boys did a better performance than me yesterday, so that put them in front of me. But at the end, we don't have to take the responsibility. I think if one of them would have taken the jersey, obviously that would have been different. But now we still can race openly, and I think next week we'll see more clearly who's the best, and probably change our tactics. But at the moment, we didn't change.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think have the form of the Giro, you could say, but I mean, I don't think it's too bad either. But yeah, I mean, the top four guys are really like going super strong. So hopefully I can find the legs a bit in the last half of the race.
Well, Brian, just looking more closely at the general classification this evening, I mean, I mentioned those three riders, and, well, there's a huge group between 8th on general classification. That's Miguel Angel Lopez. He's just over 5 minutes behind, 5:03, right down to Hugh Carthy in 15th. He's 5:58. So there are seven or eight riders within a minute of each other. And let's just run through a few of them. Well, let's start a little bit higher up. Simon Yates, 6th at 3 minutes and 8 seconds down. Now, I can tell you he wasn't very happy today after the finish either, because he won here in 2018 and he thought he had a good chance again today.
He did go up one place, but I don't think he has any reason to be particularly fond of where he is right now in the Vuelta. I still think that he'll gain a couple of places potentially on the TT. He's really, really become a great time trialist, and he can use that to his own, I think, advantage. But he still needs to show better on the climbs. And I think, without starting to talk about the other guys you mentioned, he needs to figure out, and he's one of the guys who will need to figure out if they at all can put pressure on Evenepoel, or if he can just try and jump up a few places and potentially aim for the podium. I think he's not here to ride for top five. I think he's here to try and win the bike race. So for that reason, he will need to put in a massive attack. And he can only do that at a point where Evenepoel is either isolated, but that might not be enough. He might actually have to show some kind of weakness. And if you're just waiting for that to happen, this could be a long welter before we see that, because he's certainly flying right now.
The next one down is Almeida. He's in 7th, 4 minutes 32 down. Now, he came in to the Vuelta saying that his legs didn't feel great. Now he's in an invidious position whereby I think the whole of Spain is getting excited about Juan Ayuso, his teammate, who is 2 places higher in general classification. I see Almeida now having to possibly sacrifice himself, even if the team don't spell that out. Would you agree, Brian?
Yeah, it depends on the psychology that they approach Ayuso with, because he's so young. And if they knocked on his door in the evening and said, hey, by the way, Almeida is now your helper for the rest of Vuelta, and we think you can finish on the podium. I mean, this kid has made results for a very long time, even if he's still a teenager, as you mentioned. It just depends on how he's going to react to that. I think if a smarter approach would probably be try and take it, I hate when writers say that, now I'm saying it myself, try and take it day by day and see if you can actually position yourself this well in the group of contenders, and then at some point, if you see a possibility, attack. I don't think that this is the time where he should start to ride defensively. And he's still so young, so I think he might as well throw everything at a stage win and see what's left after that.
And in the next two, Hindley Lopez, we heard from Hindley, he hasn't got his best legs, he hasn't rediscovered the form of the Giro. And I think there was a feeling among a lot of these guys that they had to come into the Vuelta a España hot, because they knew the first half of the race was full of climbs and a lot of time was going to be gained and lost in the first 10 days. And for some of them, well, they haven't quite got their timing right, because they are down over 5 minutes on general classification, and now they're probably looking at the outer edges of the top five rather than podium positions, and certainly challenging for victory. But any others that you would pick out, Brian? I mean, Theo Gegenhardt has sunk down the general classification, partly due to that crash. As we mentioned, he's now 12th. Well, any others you would pick out?
Is there a reason why we're not talking about Roglic in this connection? He is now 2 minutes behind, almost. I know he can gain something on the time trial, but I can't see him gaining anything to Evenepoel. He might, I think he'll take significant time from Mas, but can he actually take, at this point, it's almost 40 seconds from Mas? And so I think this is a big disappointment for Roglic, for sure.
At this point, I would give Remco 50% chance of winning the Vuelta, Roglic 35%, Enric Mas 10%, and 5% to someone else. That would be my breakdown, more or less. And Brian, time to change the subject. Now, this evening, the whole of the Vuelta, not just we, are embarking on an odyssey across Spain. We're going to Alicante, and this will be the second very long transfer of the Vuelta a España. Of course, we started in the Netherlands. Some of the team, some of the staff, some of the journalists drove down from the Netherlands. And, well, this obviously all has environmental implications. And there are a couple of riders at this Vuelta a España who are very worried about the environmental implications of, well, not just what they're doing as professional cyclists and as members of the professional cycling circus, but they're worried about what society at large is doing or not doing about the environment and climate change. One of those riders is Gino Maeda. He's the Bahrain victorious 25-year-old, last year's white jersey. He was fifth overall last year. He was key, actually, in Jack Haig's third place, especially on that final, that infamous final stage in Galicia, where Superman Lopez threw a bit of a tantrum and quit the race. Maeda was second at Romandie earlier this year. Didn't have the best day today either. He's another one of those riders who sort of targets in general classification. 19th now on general classification, he is, in fact. But this year, he has launched a very noble initiative whereby he is donating one Swiss franc for every rider who finishes behind him in any bike race. The other rider we're about to hear from is an old friend of the podcast, the Lynx of Marbella, in fact, Luis Angel Mate. He's from Marbella, he's 38. He's riding his 11th Grand Tour. He has pledged to donate 100 trees in the area of Spain that he comes from. We've just mentioned Marbella, and in particular the mountain range called the Sierra de Bermeja, which has been hit terribly by forest fires over the last year. So he is giving 100 new trees, and then one for every kilometre he does in a breakaway. And this is being matched by his team, the Fundazione Euskadi team and La Vuelta organisation. Now, he hasn't racked up too many kilometres so far, only 24, but he is one of the two, well, we'll call him the eco warriors in the peloton. And I spoke to both of them this morning, and we did also touch on that long transfer to Alicante.
El encuentro del día. The meeting of the day.
You're donating money for every rider that finishes behind you on this Vuelta a España. I mean, how's the Vuelta going for you so far?
Well, I not only do it for the Vuelta a España, but for the whole season, which gave me a little head start compared to last year when I only did it for La Vuelta. And I mean, obviously, my money, it won't make like the massive impact, but I just try to, well, put my money where my mouth is and get people to speak about and think about it. And, well, my Vuelta is going quite good so far, and I think my stages are still to come. I just try every day to finish as high up as possible and raise some money.
Well, Luis, we all know and we've read about your initiative for the environment here. Could you just explain for those who don't know what has been happening over the last couple of years in the Sierra de Bermeja, no?
Yeah. Last year we have one of the most catastrophic wildfires of our history in Sierra Bermeja. It's an area with a lot of ecologic value, with very important trees like pin sapo. It's an endemic tree, very, very important. It's the only place in the world that this tree, pin sapo, grown. And yeah, for us was a catastrophic. Now, 1 year later, the Vuelta comes to Sierra Bermeja. 1 year later, all the technical said we need to start the works for the reforestation. And I think the Vuelta is the best opportunity to show everybody how can do with this kind of catastrophe. Also, I always say that we cyclists, we have the best stadium in the world. Today is Asturias, tomorrow is Andalusia, after tomorrow Paris. And it's our responsibility to be care to our home, not the others. Yeah, we can think, yeah, the governments, the big enterprise, but it's our responsibility. And I think it's important to know that and, yeah, have a little bit. I think it's, if everybody have a little bit, in the final, it's a lot of.
So you're planting a tree for every kilometer you're in the break, and then La Vuelta is helping as well. And
but it's hard at the break or in the Vuelta.
I was going to say, I mean, you managed it on stage one. How is it going? Tell us how's it going for you.
Listen, the cycling changes every year. It's more hard to be in the breakaway. Everybody want to be in the breakaway. But yeah, it's a good challenge also, no, for me. But we have only in the half of the Vuelta, and I hope to do more and more and more Ks.
The fact that you're doing what you are doing with climate change and so on, I mean, what do you think about taking a second big flight, all the riders and a lot of the people that are working on the race as well?
Well, I mean, obviously it's not like the optimum. But I think in a country as big as Spain, and you want to promote the whole country and show different parts of it, as long as we kind of can raise awareness and like show maybe there's different alternatives, better alternatives, we can just use these days to raise awareness and maybe do everybody do a small little thing to help offset the CO2 we're gonna emit.
Yeah, for sure it's not the best way, you know, but when you see the public in Holland, when you see the public in the Basque Country, now the cycling and every year is more global, and yeah, for sure it's not comfortable, but we need to know that the cycling change, everybody want to have a stage, and I think it's important to have a public in every part of the world, and for that, when you see the public in Holland or in Basque Country, you say, yeah, it's hard, but I think it's good for the cycling.
Have you spoken to Gino Maeda, who's doing something similar for Bahrain Victorious? No.
I can speak with him because he's always in the front. I'm is always in the back, and I don't see you. I don't see him.
Yeah, I think we have in the most important moment of our history, with the global warming, with the change climatic.
And it's important to know that and to say to everybody that we need to act now. Now is the moment and we need to act.
Well, we are now in a really like rainy region of Spain, so it doesn't show as much, but you see pictures of yesterday tour of Germany and it looks like southern Spain. And well, it makes you think. And well, as I said, we better gonna start soon, because I think our planet is dying at an alarming rate, and some skipping points in the warming, they can't be well turned back. That's why we call them skipping points. So yeah, I just feel like we have to start soon, and we have to start really, really strong.
Well, Brian, those clips, I think, encapsulated nicely the dilemma that we all have and the impossibility of being absolutely consistent when it comes to the environment. You can be very conscious and you can be very noble, as both of the aforementioned riders are, and yet they both also acknowledge that here at the Vuelta a España, it is important that the race moves around Spain and further afield, and there are implications for that. And neither of them is particularly comfortable about it. They see it as a necessary evil.
It's something that I've become a lot more aware of in the last, say, 4 or 5 years, especially when working in California and seeing the droughts and the wildfires are almost something you can count on happening every year. But then also when you become a father, you worry a lot more about what type of world you leave for your children going onwards. And it is very alarming. And you know, we see droughts, we see pretty crazy climate changes already from, you know, from our not so distant memory from when you and I started in cycling. A lot has happened since then. But not a lot has happened in cycling in terms of not just raising awareness. I think the riders have other things to think about, but cycling hasn't really used any opportunities to become a greener sport other than using bidons that are compostable potentially, or you can't just drop things wherever you want in a bike race anymore. But other than that, cycling hasn't really done much, not as much as it could. You know, I remember from looking at the fleet of vehicles, you know, if you have, each team has a lot of cars, obviously trucks and buses and whatever, and each car on a team easily does as many kilometers as a bike rider, so in a year would almost amount to 35,000-40,000 kilometers. So cycling is green, but the sport of cycling, professional cycling, certainly isn't. So it's, I think it's good, and it would be nice if there were more riders who were helping us understand the severity of those elements, even when we talk about sport, because sport is usually something that we think is green or healthy or whatever, but professional cycling really isn't.
I really like the links of Marbella, Luis Angel's point about it being our responsibility and the responsibility of riders to cherish, treasure, preserve and beautify our natural environments, because we are, those of us who cycle or run, we are the prime beneficiaries of those environments.
Yeah, absolutely. But don't forget, whenever you see a race and whenever we enjoy all those things, there's a huge line of cars behind every single professional peloton, and there's no other way around it. There has to be cars, so there'll be no bike race. But it's, I think, other things that can be done, other initiatives. I think hopefully cycling will look, just in a few years, will look quite differently in terms of our carbon imprint. So it's good when riders speak their mind and actually do something, because that's down to all of us. If we can, you know, we can talk a lot about it, but if each and every one of us don't do anything on a daily basis to better this situation, we are doomed, I'm sorry to say.
I mean, I said the other day, Brian, that it feels unfair and churlish to criticise the Vuelta because of all of the Grand Tours. That I get the sense that they're the ones doing the most, and it's perhaps easiest for them to do the most because they're the smallest in scale. But, you know, they've got an information board displayed in the press room and elsewhere on the race. They're sort of boasting that there's a 95% reduction use of plastic bottles. They've got 190,000... fewer plastic bottles will be used thanks to these kind of big hubs where you can fill up your metal water bottles.
Is there, this is a question for you, sorry, Lynn. Do Vichy Catalan produce?
No. Did you know that Simon Yates and I bonded over our mutual love of Vichy Catalan the other day? Did you know about this? Maybe we'll play the clip later in the world.
You should.
That's a treat.
Are they not just in glass bottles then?
Vichy Catalan are generally, they are available in plastic bottles, but not on the Vuelta, unfortunately. Vichy Catalan is not available on the Vuelta, not through the official channels anyway. I have to go through my dealer. As I say, 85 hybrid vehicles, 30,000 recycled paper Segafredo cups, and it feels to me, to be bragging about these things when the race does feature these two very long transfers with flights, with all of the vehicles that were mentioned, team vehicles, journalist vehicles, and so on and so forth, having to drive across Spain. I think there is a little bit of there's a certain degree of hypocrisy there. Would you not agree?
Yeah, but you could also turn it around and say, well, at least they're trying to make up for it, right? And
yes.
And the Vuelta is starting in other countries, not just, I think, for the sake of promoting the bike race. I think that the Dutch are very well aware of the Vuelta being, now. It's a money thing, and so they're doing it for that exact reason. And there's been, the tour start in Denmark this year, and there was a lot of talk about how much money that actually cost. So, but if they're on the other hand doing something, when you want to neutralize or try to balance your carbon imprint, you have to do something at the other end. So yeah, you can say it's hypocrisy, but at least they're doing something and they're not afraid to talk about it.
Yes, and I suppose as well, by showcasing those natural environments that we talked about, like no other sporting event on earth, really, the fantastic aerial shots that we get from helicopters, they are possibly reminding a wider public of how precarious these environments are and how we do need to cherish them and protect them. And as both the Lynx of Marbella, Luis Angel and Gino said, act quickly and act decisively.
Yeah, who can disagree? But as you'll also see in those helicopter shots going into the next couple of weeks, it's bone dry. Rivers have run dry in Europe. The Po is barely existing anymore here in Italy. So you'll see the impact of our own actions and the past generation's actions in those exact images. Unfortunately, now we're not at a point where we can preserve, because some of the elements of not just natural beauty, but certain numerous ecosystems have been ruined, basically. So yeah, I agree with now is the time to actually do something.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2022 Vuelta España. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
This is Lionel interrupting for the final time this episode to say thank you very much to Science in Sport for supporting the cycling podcast. I'm sure everybody knows by now the discount code to get 25% off at scienceinsport.com is SISCP25. A big thank you from me to Science in Sport because their energy products got me round my ride today. We did 113 kilometres, Hertfordshire, into Essex, up into Suffolk and then back. The route was plotted expertly by my friend Andy, and big thank you to him and also to Paul and Lee for their company today. It was a lovely day out in the saddle. We did the 113 kilometres in 3 hours and 48 minutes of riding, which gave us an average speed of 29.9 kilometres an hour, which is not really a stat that I'm particularly obsessed by, but I was pleased that when the pace really lifted in the second half of the ride after lunch, I was able to keep up and feel pretty strong on the way in. And I think that was in no small part down to my fueling, because I was drinking the Beta Fuel, which keeps my energy levels topped up consistently through the ride. And we did stop for a proper lunch. I had beans on toast, which wasn't a huge amount to eat, but I supplemented that with an energy bake in the first half of the ride and then some of the Beta Fuel chews in the second half. And then with about an hour to go, just for good measure, a sort of belt and braces approach for the run in, I had a gel just to make sure I didn't get detached as the pace lifted. I was also, of course, wearing my MAP clothing, and I opted today for the long sleeve Evade Pro Base jersey. It was a nice warm day, but it was a little bit fresh in the morning, and I opted for the long sleeve jersey because I didn't want to take arm warmers, and I also didn't want to have to put sun cream on my arms. So the lightweight, summer weight Evade Pro base jersey is absolutely perfect for these sorts of conditions because it doesn't get too warm, even though the temperature was in the early 20s. And when we ducked into the shadows and when the breeze got up, it kept me the perfect temperature. Of course, the Cycling Podcast map jersey will be out soon. I think the release date is September the 20th. More details of that in a forthcoming podcast, but the entire Cycling Podcast collection will be available then. So listen out for that. That's more than enough from me. Now back to Daniel and the Vuelta a España coverage.
La etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
Last night, Brian, my travelling companion, and I went for Mexican in Oviedo. What were the highlights? We had some quesadillas de portobello trufado, quesadillas of portobello mushrooms with a sort of truffle sauce in them. They were pretty good. Didn't drink any wine of note last night, Brian, I'm afraid, with Mexican food. What would you have recommended with Mexican food?
That's a tough one. That's a really tough one. Maybe an albariño of Spanish white wine. Bit of acidity, bit of freshness, and some, I think it will match some of the spices pretty good.
We did have some cider, though, of course, being in Oviedo. It would be rude not to. Brian, the stage, well, we have no stage tomorrow, apart from the 800 kilometres that we'll be undertaking in the car. What do we have on Tuesday?
On Tuesday, we have a completely flat 31 kilometer time trial down in Alicante. Part of it is inland, heading towards the coast, and the last part is along the Mediterranean coast. Yeah, it'll be a big showdown, and I think it'll be a big Evenepoel show, but it will also be a showdown between the riders who still can entertain realistic hopes of the podium in Madrid.
I see Remco winning that stage, which is bad news for your prognostications, Brian.
Yeah, we'll see. Maybe we should make a bet, and I'll come to Madrid so I can see that bottle
You can buy the wine, please. Not on the Cycling Podcast budget, I should add. Brian, after that, just a quick look ahead to the stages we've got. We have on stage 11 got a stage going from Murcia. It's a bit of a big sort of tin meat factory, who El Pozo, they sponsor the race, and the stage on Wednesday will start from outside their factory in Murcia, and it will go down to Cabo de Gata on the southeasternmost point, more or less, of Spain. And that's a bit of a transitional stage. Do you know who I see winning there? Fred Wright. I had a cracking chat with Fred Wright today about the lessons that he learned from his near miss a couple of days ago.
How bad is he at winning bike races? I'm sorry.
Well, I think very soon, Brian, he'll become very good at winning bike races. I think he's going to start on Wednesday.
Okay.
Right. I think he's going to start on Wednesday, Brian. On stage 12, we have the stage that Luis Angel Mates talked about, going through or close to his, what he calls his gym, his laboratory where he trains, the Sierra de Bermeja, which has been badly affected by forest fires. But it's a summit finishing at just about 1,260 meters at Peñas Blancas, Estepona. Tough summit finish that day. Then the following day, Rondate to Montilla, another sort of transition stage, another opportunity for the breakaways with an uphill finish. And then next weekend, we have the big doubleheader in Andalucía at La Pandera. We've been there before, another extremely steep and difficult climb. And then on stage 15, we have, I guess, what most people would call the queen stage, at least in terms of the altitude of the finish, over 2,500 metres there. And, well, we'll see a big showdown, I'm sure. It's going to be a cracking week, Brian. I better get on the road down to Alicante. But I think that concludes not only the night's entertainment, but also the week's entertainment. So, Brian, I'm going to thank you. And we are going to rendezvous again next week, I believe. I'm not sure when exactly. I'm going to be working on the rota, for the second week on the journey down tomorrow.
Well, via Gandhi.
Stand by your recorder.
Via Gandhi,
you could be called up. You could be caught up at any moment, Brian. I guess, who knows, there could be a natural disaster. Actually, on that, I should say, Dan Martin's basement, I do believe, is doing better after yesterday's interruption to the podcast. There were some shocking videos that he sent me of the, I think, a mains pipe burst outside his house in Andorra, and it was quite dramatic. So he was certainly excused halfway through yesterday's podcast. But this kind of thing can happen at any moment.
Good to know.
Brian, on that note, I'm going to wish you a lovely evening and a lovely evening to all of our listeners.
Thank you, Dan, and to you.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freed, and Lionel Burney.